Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. What would you say to a yoga teacher, yoga studio owner who wants to keep the integrity of yoga in the West? Great. There's a lot to be said. The first piece is to remember that yoga means union, which means there isn't a right style of yoga and a wrong style of yoga. When we are yoga studio owners, well, that's a business. I've got rent to pay. I've got electricity bills to pay. Assuming I've got a bathroom, I've got water bills to pay. That's very real stuff. And so what ends up happening is we end up in our well-intentioned goal of bringing in people. We end up having to sell something. And I have to sell something that makes what I do different from what the guy down the street is doing. Otherwise, why will people come to my studio? And the dilemma with how most of that works is, it draws lines and borders. Well, this style of yoga is better than that style of yoga because of this and that. This is the best. This is the only one. This is the real one. So while there's, of course, nothing wrong with using marketing and whatever you need to do to attract people, to be a magnet, to be the light that draws people to you, it's important to not use, that's okay, no problem, to not use the temptation of distinctions and differences and separations, that in the service of union, we don't want to be drawing distinctions. That's piece one. Piece two is it's really important to realize that that union of which yoga speaks at its core is not just about, as we always say, our nose to our knees or our fingers to our toes. Deepest spiritual meaning. It's a union of the self to the divine. The Bhagavad Gita, my favorite topic, is 700 verses on yoga. It's a treatise on yoga. He doesn't teach one asana. In fact, the only time that asana is mentioned, it actually refers to that thing that you sit on rather than the posture that you're in. He gives a few lines about the asana. It should be not too thick, not too thin, not too hard, not too soft. And in fact, he then says very beautifully, after describing the asana, what it should be made of, now that you are established in asana, now that you are established here on my asana, you are ready to begin the practice of yoga. Which, should we ever have had any doubt about whether asana is yoga or not, that clarifies it. Once you are established in asana, you are ready to begin the practice of yoga. Clearly, they're two different things. Asana is an essential part, but it's not the fullness of yoga. And in that union, there's a lot that we are called upon to do. The eight limbs of yoga that Patanjali gave. Well, asana is limb number three. So let's go back to bricks for a moment. If I were building a house or a building, could you start on the third floor? Could I build the third floor first? Right, what would happen? Yeah, it would collapse. Without a foundation, nothing lasts. Well, the foundation of yoga, the limb one and two, are what are called the yamas and the niyamas, which is how we live. Has nothing to do with your thighs or your hamstrings or your spine or your waist. It's things like nonviolence, truthfulness, non-stealing, non-hoarding, integrity in my relationships, purity. I mean, there's 10 of them. So if we are teaching yoga or running a studio of yoga, it's not yoga if it doesn't have a foundation and a rooting and a grounding in the yamas and the niyamas. And that goes very deep because, for example, truthfulness is not sadly simply the opposite of lying. The simple fact that I haven't told you a lie does not necessarily mean I'm being truthful. Truth, capital T, truth, is who we are. Which means that we have to be rooted in the exploration of, the awareness of, the touching of, the awakening of who we are. But it also has to do with how we move through the world. So the very first one is ahimsa, nonviolence. Well, again, that doesn't just mean if I refrain from walking into my yoga studio with a gun and killing everybody, I'm nonviolent. There's violence in how we live. There's violence in how we eat. There's violence in how we shop. There's violence in what we buy. Every single time my soul agenda is more, 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 cheaper, 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 well, that's violent. It's violent to women and children in sweatshops who are there because I need more, 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 cheaper, cheaper, cheaper. It's violent to the earth because the factories then that are cutting corners are dumping their waste into our soil, into our water, into our air. So there's a lot of real deep work that's exciting. And it's an opportunity not to feel overwhelmed, but it's an opportunity to realize, wow, yoga is what I do 24 hours a day, who I am 24 hours a day. In this studio of yoga, we give you not just that for your hamstrings and your thighs and your waist, but we give you that for you so that when you walk out of here, you walk out of here a completely different way than you walked in. But the tree of yoga doesn't end on the third floor either. It goes all the way up to eight. So it's also, just as it's important not to begin with asana, it's important not to end with asana. And I won't go through all the eight limbs of yoga here, but the eighth limb is samadhi. That ecstatic bliss, union, oneness with the divine, which also means that as we're teaching, there has to be an awareness and acknowledgement of the fact that ultimately that's where we're going. And okay, it's not that Trikonasana is necessarily going to get you there today, right here, immediately. But it's about the awareness that getting your hand down on the floor in Trikonasana is the means to an end when you are established in asana. You are ready to begin the practice of yoga. So it's not, ah, I touched my toes, I'm done. It's, ah, I am established in Uttanasana. Now I am ready to begin the practice of yoga. So if you can do that, even as an attempt, even as an intention, that intention will inform and impact and affect every decision you make, everything you teach, everyone you hire. And it'll be not only doing well, but doing good.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Alaya, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me. When I meditate and have the feeling that I'm supposed to be doing something, I resist physically and spiritually. How do I overcome this resistance? When I meditate and have the feeling I'm supposed to do something, I resist physically and spiritually. How do I overcome this resistance? So first of all, it's actually good to resist doing something in meditation. So that's not a resistance to overcome. We are so indoctrinated to feel like we always have to be doing, producing, as though this moment itself were somehow lacking. And it's up to me to do something to improve this moment, to fix this moment. And so we bring that even into our meditation. I have to do something. Interestingly, the questioner feels resistant to doing that, which is great because meditation is actually, it's not about doing. It's about undoing. That which we do in meditation is just a technique. It's just a tool. So we watch the breath. We chant a mantra. We may recite a name. There's a lot of different techniques of meditation, but they're all tools. They're not the doing for doing's sake. It's not reciting God's name because God's up there going, "When is somebody going to recite my name, please?" It's not reciting God's name because somehow listening to his, her name makes God happy, and so God blesses you the more you take the name. It's not that. We take God's name for us. So the doing that we do in meditation is actually a tool to get us beyond this very limited way of thinking, this very limited way of being. We spend our time stuck in our minds. The mind's not bad. The mind's not our enemy. The mind is a wonderful tool. The problem is that we're at the mercy of it. If I sat here in front of you, and as I was talking to you, I started flailing my arms all over the place like this. And I said, "Oh, don't worry about that. They're just my silly arms." Yeah, they do that sometimes. You'd think there's something really, really wrong with this lady. And then if I started bouncing up and down on my legs and I said, "Oh, don't worry. Yeah, they're just my silly legs. They do that sometimes." You'd think, really, there's something wrong with her. But interestingly, even though we understand so intuitively that our arms and our legs should be under our control, even we understand that our tongues should be under our control. We say something that we regret, we say, "That wasn't me." So we understand that I should have the control. But my mind, this extraordinary, exquisite organ, limb, muscle, amazing creation thing, whatever we call it, that actually is the steering wheel for our life, that is that determining where we go, what we do, who we are, how we are, we just let it run all over. "Oh yeah, that's just my silly mind. Can't control it." And so meditation pulls us out of that. Because the issue with the mind is it can only function in separation. It can think about. As long as it can hold something at an arm's length and think about it. A math problem, a checkbook, my annoying neighbor, whether the colors in my living room match, whatever it may be. If I'm using my mind, I have to be able to hold what I'm thinking about at an arm's distance. I'm thinking about it. I'm judging it. I'm understanding it. I'm comparing it. I'm making lists of pros and cons. I'm deciding. But who we are isn't something you want to hold at an arm's length. When we do that, we end up suffering even more. That's the, "You're stupid, you're worthless, you're nothing, you're fat, you're ugly, you're a failure, you're a victim." That's the thinking about ourselves. And of course, it can go the other way. "You're the best, you're the smartest, everybody else is an idiot, you're the only one who knows anything, you should be in charge, either way." But again, that's holding myself at an arm's length, full of course of all the illusions, but I'm not even going to talk about that now. But meditation actually brings us into connection, oneness, union. That's what yoga means, union. Well, I can't unite with something if I'm holding it at an arm's length. whether it's another being, whether it's God, whether it's myself. You can't unite if it's an arm's length away. And this is where meditation actually takes us out of the mind. And so, if we're focused on doing, we're still in the mind. I've got to do, because if I do, I either do well or I do badly. And if I'm doing, I can always do better. And if I'm doing, there's comparison and competition. Other people do better. And if I'm doing, then I'm not actually meditating. Because as you're in the mind, and if you meditate for a while, you'll see inevitably you'll have one of those moments where you get to this very, very deep space. You're one with the breath. Then you're one with all. You're one with the universe. And then the mind comes in and goes, is this it? Is this enlightenment? Am I there? This is it. And the minute that happens, it's over. Whatever it was. The minute the mind kicks in, it's over. And this is why it's so important to realize meditation is not about doing. It's about undoing. It's about sinking out of the patterns and the ways of thought, sinking out of roles, titles, responsibilities, identities, masks we wear. A beautiful meditation practice is as you meditate, every time you exhale, just let another one of them go. Literally, just exhale them, another responsibility, another identity, another mask, another role. Just let them go. And slowly as we meditate, we actually sink into a space of just isness. Or amness. It's not even so much I am, but just amness or isness. So a resistance to doing is good in meditation, but allow yourself to undo. So rather than focusing on what you're going to do in meditation and then resisting that, as you sit to meditate, allow the different things that you do the rest of the time to just appear. Don't try to think about them. I guarantee you thoughts will come. And if they don't, you're very blessed. Consider yourself very lucky if you close your eyes to meditate and thoughts don't come. So just enjoy it. But they'll come. And the thoughts that will come are the thoughts directly related to that false identity, to those roles, to those masks. And then just let them go. Breathe them out. Think about meditation as a warm bath for your soul. Now, I say that very specifically because when you come home at the end of a day, the end of a day of work, and you're tired and you're stressed and the body's aching and you decide, I'm going to take a hot bath, what do you do? What must you do before you get in a hot bath in order for it to be relaxing? Take your clothes off. Yes, exactly. You got to get naked. You could have the most beautiful bathtub, the most wonderful aromatherapy scents and salts from the Dead Sea. And I mean, you could have everything. But if you get into that bathtub in your suit and tie and your shoes and your hat, is the body going to go, or no? Right? Anybody think there's even a possibility of an in a bathtub in your pants and your shoes or your shirt or your dress? Of course not. So in the same way, when we go to meditate, think about it literally as you are lowering yourself. Sometimes when I lead a meditation, we focus on the Swadhisthana chakra, which is this energy center, right? Just a few inches right below the belly button. We focus on sinking down into it. And so when you meditate, literally think about, visualize rather, lowering yourself into this infinite, borderless, boundaryless ocean of warmth, that source of light, of love, of truth, and you're just being lowered into it. But along the way, you let go. The pants and the shirt and the tie and the hat and the shoes. You let go of your story. You let go of the anxieties. You let go of the attachments. You let go of the ego. You let go of the fight against the ego. You let it all go so that you can literally just merge and melt into that. Into that spacious source. So it's an undoing in meditation rather than a doing. And if you find yourself still resistant, it's okay. Do it anyway. Sometimes the false self, the ego, the identity, the story, all of that, it holds a very tight grip on us. We've dedicated our lives to it. We've built our lives around our story. I am this way because. I do this because. This is who I am. This is what I like. This is what I am like. That's just me. We create all of these identities out of the bricks of that which has happened to us mostly in early childhood. How we've reacted to it, how we've responded to it. We create these identities out of these bricks that end up suffocating ourselves. Literally, we are building jails that become tombs in these identities that suffocate us. A brick after a brick after a brick. This is who I am. This is who I am. This is who I am. But it's strong and it's powerful, and especially if we've dedicated decades of our lives to it. But as Pooja Swamiji, my guru, always says, whenever you wake up, it's morning. So don't worry how long you've been putting those bricks one on top of the other. It doesn't matter. Right now, in this moment, in this breath, right here, you can undo it, because it turns out those bricks are a figment of your imagination. Turns out you haven't actually laid them in a proper foundation in the ground with mortar and whatnot. You've just created it in your mind. And the minute that you decide that no longer is the creation I will live under as, you can disable it. But the ego is not going to be super excited about that. And the dilemma is that in this very physical skull in which sits my very physical brain, it's the home of, not the actual existence, but it's the home of the medium through which I experience the mind, the ego. And so every time I have a thought that says, ah, today I'm going to annihilate my ego. Well, who hears me say that? Who's sitting right there? The ego, right? So the ego's listening to me say, today is the day I'm going to become free of the ego. And the ego's like, oh, not so fast. I don't think so. So then the ego plays these games. It's there. It knows you're planning, you're plotting. Today I'm going to do this meditation, that meditation. It's going to free me of the ego. It's ready. And it's ready with its own strategy. And that's where it's so important not to fight it, not to think of it as a battle, but actually to allow the meditation to be something that simply literally is creating so much space, is giving you the experience of being so spacious that, yeah, there is an ego. There is a history of the body, of the brain, of the patterns, of the sanskaras. But it isn't me. And I sink into a spaciousness. Of truth. And that's what happens when we meditate.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM radio network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Like Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip or the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with inspiration and transformation. The koans are, they're tools in particularly the Zen tradition, but probably other traditions as well of Buddhism, that you, they're questions or statements that you meditate upon. And there are things like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? I mean, that's a very famous one, but there's many, many of them. Probably an infinite number of them, as infinite as there are masters. But they are questions where, or statements where the answer is not actually the point, but the point is what happens to your mind when you meditate upon it. When you get to a place in a question or a statement that cannot be answered by the logical mind, one of a few things happens. Either you say, forget it, this is stupid, and you stand up and walk out the door, and that's the end of your meditation practice and training. Or you have the faith in the master, the faith in the divine, the faith in the process, or the extraordinary yearning for the truth that you are prepared to sit through that which seems crazy and senseless. And you're going to just take a leap. In fiction writing, they call it willing suspension of disbelief. So I have willingly suspended my disbelief into a place where the intellectual mind cannot go. Because where most of us, what we try to do is we try to go in intellectually. Okay, the sound of one hand clapping, well, maybe it's something like, because that's kind of the sound my hand makes, sort of, sometimes. Then you realize there isn't really a sound. Or a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it. Does it make a sound? Right? So you start, the intellectual mind begins, but it hits a wall really quickly. And that's when either we walk away because we are not prepared to go there, because we are a little too wrapped up in the intellectual mind and things making sense, or we willingly suspend that disbelief and we say, all right, let's go there. Let's go to a place where my mind cannot take me. And they're used as a tool for awakening because ultimately all of these different meditation techniques are ways to get the mind to become still so that we can experience the truth of that which exists when the mind isn't running. And so whether we are focusing on a candle flame or a word or a mantra or our breath or a prayer or a koan, they're all techniques to get the mind to just stop. So that in that space, we can experience that which is. And so could science be used as a koan? You'd have to go into it purposely for that. Because the dilemma is that science actually keeps giving answers. So if you say to scientists, if a tree falls and there's no one to hear, does it make a sound? Well, not only will they give you an answer, but they'll give you a chart to plot the sound waves, and it's based on the height of the tree and the velocity at which it's falling, based on the ratio of mass to gravity, etc., etc. So you'll have to jump through a lot of hoops before you get to a place where there no longer is an answer. So if you take it as that, then sure, anything can. Because remember, these are all just techniques. But for me, with science, rather than using the limitedness of science as a way to still my mind, I'd rather use science for what science can give us, which is a lot. Science is fantastic. But then when I'm looking to go somewhere where I know science can't take me, instead of using science as my tool to get there, I kind of leave science aside and shift into the loving heart. So you come out of the intellectual mind that's needing the tools, that's needing the evidence, the proof, the method. And you shift into the heart, which just loves, and which is really a doorway into this expansive awareness that just isness. So see if that works. Rather than trying to use science to get beyond science, it's like trying to use the mind to get beyond the mind. It's not something that's very easy, and that's why the practices of meditation are all about that which gets us beyond the mind. And that's where, for example, the path of Gyan Yoga, you know, we have these different paths to awakening, paths to union with God. Path of bhakti, love, devotion, path of karma, service, path of Gyan, wisdom. And yet, the path of Gyan Yoga is, to me, one of the most difficult paths because it is using the mind, and yet it's ultimately taking you beyond the mind. Whereas a path of love or a path of service feels to me much easier than the path of wisdom. Now, that being said, I have been in the presence of a Gyan Yoga master who was there. He had reached there. His eyes shone in the presence. Like he was living in the presence of God, even though he had gone in this very difficult, or to me, seemingly difficult path. But once you go in that path of the mind, it takes you beyond the mind anyway. So even though his path was a path of inquiry and wisdom, it took him into love. His eyes flowed with tears at love for God. So could you use science to get beyond science? Probably eventually, if you were super tenacious about it. But are there other ways that may be easier? Yeah, I think there's a lot of them. And for me, I feel like we need all the help we can get. Time is so short. And every minute is so precious to get to that truth, to wake up. That for me, it's always about what's the easiest, fastest path to get there, rather than what's the most sort of difficult, convoluted one.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force, routine discipline with a hook or whip or the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation. We view death, first of all, as absolutely inevitable. Now that seems obvious. But how many of us live as though we're never going to die? Or live out of fear of death, as though somehow we could keep it at bay? Neither is possible. Neither can you escape death, nor are you going to be exempt from it. So we first take it as a given. And then on both levels, both the human and the divine level, we say, okay, so now that I've accepted death, well, death obviously only pertains to the human body, it doesn't pertain to the soul. So on the highest spiritual level, we realize I'm never born, I'm never going to die. So we don't worry too much about what I'm going to accumulate in this lifetime. We realize who I am is soul. I'm not the owner of these things. I'm not the owner of the bank account. I'm not the one in the title or the role of the career. We don't grab. We don't grasp, we don't fear, because we understand. As so beautifully in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna tells us, the soul is that which cannot be burned by fire, cannot be cut by knives, cannot be dried by wind, cannot be wet with water. So what to fear? So we live in that fearlessness, that open-hearted, full courage, knowing I'm just in this body doing my dharma, doing my duty, but I'm not the doer. So that's how we recognize it from the awareness that I'm eternal. In the awareness of my humanness, we realize every moment is precious. Because death is coming. Which means I better be very careful of how I spend every moment. It means I better be very careful about what I do because of this law of karma that I get to keep coming back to bear the fruits of that, to enjoy or not enjoy the fruits of it. Whatever seeds I plant, I'm the eater of the fruit of that tree. And so I become very careful about what seeds I'm planting. I become very careful about how I spend my time. I find myself no longer engaging in things that are useless. I don't gossip. I don't waste time. You don't spend time complaining about others. You don't spend time bemoaning the past or worrying about the future, because you know this moment is precious. The moments of that past I am bemoaning have already gone. I've lost them already. The moments of the future have not yet come. There's nothing I can do about them. But I'm losing this moment in anxiety about them. And so we become very careful about every moment and the preciousness of it. And we make sure that how we're spending every moment is in the very best service of our own awakening, for me to be able every moment to realize I'm soul, I'm spirit, to move through the world, connecting with others as that. And to do whatever I need to do to live however I need to live, such that every moment is very well spent. Every moment is spent in love, in service, in truth. Then, whenever death comes, we're ready. Doesn't mean we don't love the body, doesn't mean we don't love this beautiful drama we've been offered an opportunity to play a role in. Doesn't mean that there isn't a bit of sadness of loss. But we know I'm not disappearing, I'm not going anywhere. Because ultimately who I was never born and never dies. So no attachment, exactly. But that no attachment does not mean I live in apathy or indifference or laziness. A lot of people misunderstand non-attachment as I don't care. You hear people say things like, you know, I've become really good at non-attachment. I now can walk down the street past all of the lepers and the starving children and the poor people, and I don't feel anything. Like somehow that is some great spiritual accomplishment. It isn't. Non-attachment doesn't mean I stop being human. It doesn't mean that I squeeze the life out of this exquisite human heart I've been given. It doesn't mean that I take compassion, throw it out the window. But it simply means I am aware that there is only one thing in life I have any control over. And that is my own reaction or response to every moment. I don't have control over how other people speak or live or behave. I don't have control of the weather. I don't have control of the traffic or the stock market. And so to be attached to it going one way or another way is just a recipe for misery. And so non-attachment is realizing I don't have any control. And my joy, my peace, my awakening does not have to be dependent upon that. I don't hook myself into what happens in the outer world. I hook it deeply inside. So the things of the world no longer hold that grip on me. When you've tasted and experienced deep spiritual bliss, a shopping trip is no longer nearly so exciting. It's not that you have to push away shopping. I'm not going to shop anymore. It's not that. It's that automatically, as you connect deeply with that river, that eternal, ever-flowing river of joy, of bliss inside you, certain items, certain titles, certain roles, this, that, it loses its hold on you. So that's the non-attachment that comes. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week. And I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on Om Times Radio.
Thank you.